Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jennifer Yeremeyeva, and today we are off to the seaside. My guest is Peter Naldret, author of Around the Coast in 80 Days, a guide to Britain's best coastal towns, beaches, cliffs, and headlands from Bloomsbury Publishing this year. This was a particularly lovely read during the COVID-19 lockdown. I'm based in Western Massachusetts, but reading about the charms of seaside towns such as Newbiggin-by-the-Sea, Folkestone, Rosslea, and Clacton-on-Sea, I could feel the briny wind in my hair and my stomach was rumbling for some battered fish and chips with salt and vinegar. Around the Coast in 80 Days doesn't just whet the appetite for the manifold charms of Britain's extensive coastline. It offers a curated list of sights, sounds, quirky traditions, and historical milestones and firsts for 80 of Britain's most attractive seaside venues. I learned, for example, about the origin of the tongue twister She Sells Seashells by the Seashore, and where sticky toffee pudding was first invented, and about a mysterious grotto made up of over 4.6 million seashells, which may have been a pagan shrine, and I'm certainly keen to learn more about that. I have traveled to many of these places, but so many more were new to me, so I'm very excited to have the opportunity to learn more about Britain's enchanting coastline from Peter Naldret today, and it gives me such great pleasure to welcome him to our podcast. Peter, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure. And I loved reading the book. And I wondered if we could start by what inspired you to go on this journey around Britain and what was the inspiration behind the book?
Well, I do like to travel and I'm a travel writer. So we've quite a few years experience doing different things. And I just love the seaside. and I'm also a bit of a keen list person, so I like a lot of the books that I've written. I've got like a tick list where you can go around and sort of say that you've visited each of these places, so everything seemed to fall in, and the sort of title of it obviously has its origins with the classic Jules Verne story.
It all seemed to
come together, and also there's a little bit of the story about the around the world in 80 days is sort of how I got interested in travel, really, and became geography teacher at school. So there was a TV series in the 1980s with the comedian Michael Palin from Monty Python, and he did a sort of modern version of Around the World in 80 Days, and that sort of captured my imagination and got me interested in travel, really. So I don't know, one day, I don't know where it came from. I just thought, wouldn't it be good if we did it around the coast in 80 days? And so it all came together.
So did it take you 80 days or a bit longer? I wonder what your methodology was, how you went about doing the research and how did what did that actually look like?
So the book is not really designed to go on one journey of like an 80 days, because I think if you did it in 80 days, you'd miss too much. So what I've tried to do is create a book with 80 of the best places to visit around the coast. And a lot of them can be day trips. Now, that's a sort of concept that a lot of people in some countries will struggle with, the concept of a day trip to the seaside, because they're a long way from the seaside. In Britain, of course, fortunately, the furthest away you can be from the coast is about 72 miles. So everybody is within a 2-hour drive of somewhere on the coast. And so what I've tried to do is get together the best places where you can have a day trip to the seaside, with options of staying over, you know, making it a long weekend, because there's just so much to do in these places.
So did you work on this for a year or 2 years?
Probably 2 years, actually.
2 years, yeah.
So some of them I did do as day trips, and others like took a bit of a longer journey, going off for 2 weeks at a time. But overall, it was a 2 year program, yeah.
And you've made it much easier for someone like me to kind of drop down into a place like Brighton and find the highlights. And I think one of the great appeals of the book, sort of universal appeal, is that you've got a little something for everybody. I think sports fans will find what they need. History buffs and bird watchers, nature enthusiasts. And I just want to ask you how on earth you managed to winnow down so many appealing things into, I think, about 3 or 4 highlights for each venue. What were the criteria that went into that?
It was really difficult. I tried to avoid too much repetition because obviously, you know, most of these places have got beaches and things like that. But when you visit the place, maybe go to the tourist information office, do a bit of research online, you'll find out that a lot of them have got unique features, things that other places just haven't got. And in the end, the 3 or 4 sort of must-do things for each destination stood out. And yeah, we've got a little bit of sport in there. So Premier League fans of football, you've got Liverpool on the coastline. You've got Brighton on the coastline as well, and Southampton, which are Premier League teams, just a stone's throw away from the water. And like you say, there's a lot of castles on there, a lot of wildlife areas where you can go bird watching. So each area had its own sort of distinct 3 or 4 things to do, and just try to get as much variation in there as possible.
Right, but then there's some things that each seaside town has in common, and that speaks to the kind of tradition of the day trip to the seaside, which has a very venerable place in British life, I think. And I wonder, for our listeners who aren't as familiar with that, if you could kind of encapsulate what the British seaside zeitgeist is and what are its key elements.
Yeah, it's something that runs deep in everybody that's born here, really. Again, partly I think because we are an island and nobody is that far away from the seaside. I mean, I live in Sheffield, which is about as far away from the coast as you can get in the sort of middle of the country, and I'm about 2 hours away from both the east coast and the west coast. So everybody is sort of on. Everybody has the potential to get there really quickly. I think we've seen that in as lockdown's been eased, as soon as people got a little bit of freedom to go travelling, it was the coastal areas that they went to. And so the beaches have been very busy over the last few weeks, because it's just a place that people normally flock to. Mm-hmm. And I think the history of the British coastline and the traditional seaside destination started probably going back to Victorian days in the 19th century. And the places like Blackpool and Morecambe and Brighton became very popular for factory workers and people working in the big cities like Manchester and London. And as soon as the union movement got bank holidays introduced and people got a little bit of more holiday time, they would all take off to the seaside. A lot of it depended on where the trains were running to as well at that time. So the places with the train station managed to get the tourists in from the big cities. And in fact, some of the places along the coastline were actually had train lines going directly to them for the sole purpose of getting tourists to there from the cities. So the idea of a day trip to the seaside really is a Victorian one, when people had the like odd days off work. In fact, one of the most famous travel companies, which no longer exists, but Thomas Cook.
Oh, yes.
Thomas Cook was a real person, Thomas Cook, in Victorian days, and he was one of the first people to sort of grasp onto this idea of people going on a day trip to the seaside. So he put on sort of the first package tours, if you like, with travel and accommodation at the seaside for people. So,
and what would they find when they got there?
Well, as these coastal destinations grew, they became a hive of activity. So you would have really amazing, like theatrical shows, stand-up comedy, family shows, amusement arcades full of attractions. They would develop these vast ornate wooden piers structures that just go out into the sea, so people can go out for a walk, literally out to sea above the waves. And all these things grew up as the coastal destinations gained popularity and more people went to them and they got more and more investment. They were properly, certainly in the early 20th century, some of the biggest names in show business and entertainment would go to places like Blackpool to do a season of their shows in the theatre on the end of the pier. I mean, it was, comparable to the sort of like Vegas kind of type of residency, if you like. They would go and they would stay and they would do like a month on the pier doing a couple of shows every day. And because the places were so popular, they'd sell out for the entire run.
And I think you mentioned in one, I can't remember which venue or region it was, where Laurel and Hardy were a popular act. Is that, am I remembering that correctly?
That's right. So they actually did a tour and spent a bit of time going round the seaside, the traditional seaside destinations, Laurel and Hardy.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and extremely popular when they came back, especially as they'd become famous and people had seen them on the movies.
And so all of that, the pier, the amusement park, the theatre, has in some venues remained and is still an attraction today. Is that right?
Yes, it has. Mm-hmm. I mean, only recently I went to see a band on the end of Blackpool Pier with Damon Albarn, The Good, the Bad and the Queen, and it was a spectacular thing. Uh-huh. just to be in the setting, this historical setting. It was quite remarkable, knowing that you're watching this thing and you're actually above the sea. But it would be unfair, I think, to sort of say it is as it was, because as we entered the sort of 1970s, 80s and 90s, there was a really significant decay that set in to these seaside towns. And a lot of them still haven't recovered, to be fair. But as soon as we got into the 1980s, holiday habits in the United Kingdom changed completely, because we'd got jet aircraft and going to Spain and Greece, and Italy became the sort of summer destination more than going to your Brightons and your Blackpools and your Cornwalls. So a lot of traditional seaside destinations really struggled in the 1980s and 1990s. And they've had a lot of reinvestment to try to entice these people back there. But a lot of people go there for the day rather than going there for the week like they might have done in the 1930s through to the 1960s. So they've had to really change the way that they market themselves. And, some of them you can really see like green shoots and they're really sort of booming again. Mm. Others still really struggling. And, some of them are a little bit grotty, to be honest.
But you also note that in a number of the towns, they've taken the harbour area and sort of done a massive sort of urban renewal project, in Hull and I think Morecambe, mentioned. Tell us more about that.
There's been millions of pounds spent on redeveloping British seaside destinations because of this sort of decline that we experienced a few decades ago. So we've got one example is Morecambe, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of money being spent on the promenade at Morecambe, not to do anything, massively dramatic, but we've got a bit of art in there. We've got some sculptures. We've got a nice pedestrian area with some gardens, with some water features, just making it a nicer place really to experience. And that's been the key factor at a lot of these sort of coastal towns, just to try and smarten it up a little bit, I think.
Mm. And another thing that struck me reading through the book was the really staggering number of festivals that take place in seaside towns. You have a lot of literary festivals, obviously, music, food, that all makes sense. And then there's some quite fun ones, more esoteric, like Padstow's Hobby Horse Festival that takes place in May, which I've got to take my daughter to because she's a very keen equestrian and a hobby horse enthusiast. If our listeners could go to just one festival at a seaside town, which one would you recommend?
Well, people, the seaside destinations love a festival. And the, as you said, the extent of them and the range of them is quite astonishing. And I think the reason, there's a serious reason that it's done behind it. And I think it's basically to extend the tourist season. Mm-hmm. So rather than just having people go there during the summer holidays, it's the idea, let's try and get them here a little bit earlier and let's lure them here a little bit later as well. If I was to choose one, I would go to a place in the northwest of England called mm-hmm. Whitby. And that's a stunning place. And the history of the Goth Festival in Whitby has its roots in the story of Dracula. So Dracula, Bram Stoker visited Whitby, was inspired by the ruins of the abbey on the cliff top there. And in the story of Dracula, when Dracula comes over from Transylvania on the boat, he actually arrives in Whitby. And there's a lot of Dracula-related sort of theme shops and stuff in Whitby. And a couple of times a year, they have a goth festival where people will go and sort of dress up in the most unbelievable outfits. And it is literally just a fantastic weekend to go and just to stare at some of the sights. Really, really interesting. And then at night, everybody hangs out in the small pubs that have been frequented by fishermen for centuries.
Fantastic. And now you had a wonderful picture of that in the book.
Yes. It is literally like an outdoor Comic-Con for goth. And once a year as well, they throw an element of steampunk in there as well. So it's like the Goth and the Steampunk Festival. And some of the costumes are stunning, really.
That's amazing. All right, let's now put you through your paces, Peter. Your book is divided into 9 different regions. You've divided Britain, which includes Scotland and Wales and England. And you move clockwise from Liverpool around Britain and you end up in Wales. Do you have a favorite region of these 9?
No, I don't. Love them. I love each one for very different reasons. And I thought about that. I thought, you might be asking, do I have a favorite area? And I don't. I think if you ask me on a given day 4 times, I'd give 4 different answers. I think that they really are just all very special for different reasons.
Okay. But as the lockdown eases, where are you going to be headed to first?
I am going to be heading to Scotland first. It's a bit of a trek. So, you know, we're talking to get to the north of Scotland, we're talking like a 10-hour drive from our home. But when you get up there, it's the ideal destination, I think, to go as lockdown ends, because there will be hardly anybody else there.
There you go.
And you won't have to go very far at all before you find a beach that's just deserted and you're the only one on there.
Oh, it's gorgeous. All right. Well, we're a little ahead of ourselves because we need to begin in the Northwest. And what I'd like you to do is kind of just go through each of these 9 regions and give us whet our appetite. Don't go into too much detail, but give us a short encapsulation so that our armchair travelers can make their choice for where they'd like to go in our lockdown.
So a few highlights from each of the regions.
Yeah. So we begin in the Northwest around Liverpool.
We start in the northwest of England. The book starts in Liverpool, and of course, in Liverpool, you have got you've got a couple of days you can spend immersing yourself in the history of the Beatles. So there's a fantastic Beatles museum there. There's a sort of replica of the Cavern Club there, and there's a mystery tour. You can go on a magical mystery tour around Liverpool to find the site. One of the other real favourite things in the Northwest is in a place called Morecambe Bay, which is very, very dangerous to go on the sands there because there is quicksand, basically. And over the years, there have been lots of people who've died there, some quite recently as well. But there is, in a place called Grangeover Sands, there is a person whose job is called the Queen's Guide to the Sands. And he is the designated royally approved person to guide people across Morecambe Bay. And this is it's like a charity walk these days. But you can book onto one of those and go for a 3-hour walk across Morecambe Bay. And you'll end up, you know, up to your torso in water at times. And you've got to follow the instructions very carefully in case it turns dangerous. But it's a fabulous walk.
That sounds gorgeous. So then you head north up to the west of Scotland.
Yeah.
Which is where you say you're headed.
Yeah. If I had to choose somewhere to go there, I would be heading up to a place called Cape Wrath, which is the most northwestern extreme place you can go in Scotland, in the United Kingdom. You can't take your car there. You literally have to park in a lay-by, wait for a ferryman to take you across a river, and then wait for a minibus to pick you up and take you on an 11-mile drive along a rickety old track to a lighthouse at the end there. And it's you literally on the edge of the world and sort of looking north across the North Sea, knowing that it's like Iceland is the next thing.
Iceland.
Yeah, so that's absolutely, absolutely stunning.
Right. You need some whiskey to warm you up.
Yes, that was another advantage because we visited quite a few distilleries as we were going around. And in the west of Scotland, actually, Oban is a town completely fueled by whiskey, really, because it sort of grew up around its distillery, and that's still very important for it.
Right. And so then we head east to East Scotland. And what's the difference between west and east in that part of the world?
I think you probably get more sort of wilderness. Well, do you know? That's a very difficult question. I think that between as you go further north in Scotland, it becomes far more like wild, remote and barren. And generally the bigger cities are sort of further south. I think on the western side, it's a little bit more remote than the east, because on the east you've got sort of cities like Inverness and Aberdeen on the eastern side, and that goes down to Edinburgh. It was just a way of splitting the two up, really. If I was to pick a place on the east coast, a highlight for people to visit, you've got St Andrews, which is like the home of golf, and some amazing golf courses there right on the edge of the water. And there's a famous cafe there where Prince William met Kate Middleton as well. Oh. And that was where they went to university. And the beach there is stunning. And it's where they shot the famous beach scene in Chariots of Fire.
Right.
And then a little bit further south, we've got South Queens Ferry right on the edge of Edinburgh. So you can get to do all the Edinburgh things as well. But it's all about the bridges there, and the famous Forth Road Bridge is absolutely stunning, and right on the edge of that little tiny little town, which used to be.
And you've got some stunning bridges in this book. I mean, obviously that makes sense. But wow,
The Forth Bridge is my favourite. It really is. It's absolutely stunning, and South Queens Ferry, it obviously gets its name from the ferry that used to go across the Firth of Forth to the place on the opposite side called North Queens Ferry, and they were linked. But then when the bridges came, obviously knocked the ferry on its head. But we have a phrase in Britain called if a task is impossible or ongoing forever, it's like painting the fourth bridge, because the fourth bridge is so big that once you finish painting it, you've got to start again at the other side.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Okay. And then heading south, we come to England proper. We're back in England, and we're on the sort of east coast. What do we find there?
Well, a couple of places stand out, really. One is Bamber. There's a very famous castle, Bamber Castle, which was few years ago voted the best view in Britain. And it's just this like magnificent sandstone castle on top of some rocks near a very, very beautiful beach. Near there also, we've got Holy Island, which is a tidal island. You've got to be careful when you can get across. You can only get across at low tide. And that has got centuries of sort of religious history around it. And it was the place where the Vikings first landed when they came and invaded Britain. So, a lot of history, a lot of Viking history, a lot of history of monks and stuff dotted around there.
Right. And is the Holy Isle the same as Avalon in the sort of Arthurian legends, or am I mixing those up?
King Arthur, we've got King Arthur mentioned in the book, but he's at the other end of the country.
He's at the other end, yeah.
Yeah, he's down a place called Tintagel.
Right.
So Tintagel is where King Arthur's castle is down in Cornwall.
That's right. Okay.
And they've just actually spent a lot of money there because the place where the castle was used to be connected via a natural bridge, and that's fell into the sea. And they've just built a new bridge there, helping people get to what was considered to be King Arthur's castle. But no, Holy Island is more Vikings, really, than Merlin.
Right, okay. Yeah. I just had a fascinating author on last week talking about Viking women. Right. Which was really, really interesting. Okay, but we digress, and we're heading south again to what you refer to as the East Coast.
Yeah, so the East Coast is a coast that's in places disappearing very, very quickly because a lot of soft rock there and sort of ferocious waves, and so there are some places where it's disappearing by a meter or two every year. And one place, which is a beautiful place to walk to, is called Spurn Point, and it's like a coastal spit on the end of, and it's near Hull actually. And there's a little community living at the end of this road, but the road's been washed away many, many times, rebuilt, and then battered again by the sea. And I think they've pretty much given up on it now. So there's plenty of places on that east coast where you can see, you know, the power of the sea and how really it's uncompromising. And there are places there where you can see evidence of houses that have been washed into the coast. And there was one famous hotel that just disappeared practically overnight. And so very, very, very dangerous. Also a place called Bempton Cliffs there, which is one of the sort of centres for our coastal bird population. You can go on a boat trip out there and see thousands of puffins, and it's just amazing how they will leave the cliff, go and get some fish from the sea, and then on these vast cliffs go to the exact ledge that they left from so they can feed the young. It's quite amazing how they managed to do that.
Fantastic. And then you head, you sort of swing south again, and we're still on the east coast, what you call the southeast.
Yeah.
And for listeners who are already confused, the book has the most lovely map of all these places in the front that makes it very clear where you are and how you're moving around Britain in that way. So we're in the southeast.
Yeah, and I think great things to do in London, which of course is a coastal destination because it's tidal in London. The Thames, when you're in the centre, stood next to the Houses of Parliament, you can see whether it's low or high tide because it's tidal down there. So there's lots of things to do in London. A place called Southend in the southeast, which has got the longest pier in the world, and literally it's a long walk to get to the end of it. And thankfully, there's a train that takes you over to the end of it, so you can save your legs as well. Probably my favourite place down in the south east is Dover, though. The castle there is just incredible. Loads of history linked to it. And, of course, Dover has also, for the traveller, got lots of, connotations of going away. You know, if you're British, most people have to go to Dover to get to France. So there's a long tradition of either getting on the Channel Tunnel or getting on a ferry and going on adventures.
I learned from your book that Hitler didn't destroy Dover Castle because he planned to use it as his headquarters.
That's right.
Yeah.
So you could imagine that on the southeast of England, there were places during World War II that got absolutely bombarded with during air raids. There's a place there called Margate and Ramsgate also. And as the planes went and sort of bombed cities further inland, but as they were coming back, because they had to lighten the plane so they could get home, as they were going over, a lot of the time they used to throw off and discharge the bombs that they'd not used. So a lot of time the coastal areas used to get hit twice, coming in and then going out again. So, there's a lot of history of bombardment. Dover, because it's literally, 25 miles away from the coast of France over the English Channel, used to get hit a lot. But Dover Castle, as you say, probably the first thing that the planes would come to, they didn't touch it. The belief there is that Hitler was going to use it, having taken over Britain, he was going to use it as his very sort of triumphant base, because it is that kind of, it has got that sort of grand feel to it. And during the Second World War, it was used as a command centre by the British Army. And so if you've seen the film Dunkirk about the evacuation there, that was all planned from tunnels underground beneath Dover Castle. In the famous White Cliffs of Dover, there are actually secret underground tunnels in there, and the Dunkirk evacuation was planned in those tunnels.
Oh, my goodness. But there are no bluebirds in the White Cliffs of Dover.
No, that's just me.
Which is really, really upsetting.
No, you won't see a bluebird, I'm afraid.
Oh, that's very, very upsetting. So let's move on. Let's move to the extreme south, the south coast.
Yeah, my standout place here is called, it's a stretch of the coastline, really, called the Jurassic Coast.
Yes.
And it's throughout the years, many fossils, dinosaur fossils have been found here. There's a very good visitor centre to visit there. And there's even sort of places where you can hire geologists, hammers, and head out onto the beach and find some of the rocks that have fallen from the cliff, and, have a hammer of them and break them open, see if you can find any fossils. And you will find fossils.
Oh, wow, fantastic. And then we come to, I think, probably my favourite part of your beautiful country, which is the Southwest.
Yeah, so the Southwest.
I think I'm not alone in that.
Absolutely not. So during the summer months, you will find a lot of people heading down to the Southwest, partly because it's got the best weather, really, in the summer, and also because it's got, without doubt, I would have thought, the best beaches and the best coastline, and a whole tourist industry has grown up around it. So these places are, in particular, Devon and Cornwall. I mean, these are places where I went every summer when I was a kid, and then have taken my son and daughter there practically every year since they were, three or four. It's a place where you get literally hooked into and you can't help but going back, because they are just such fun family times that you have down there. So,
and there's just, I think, so many different things. It's like surfer heaven. And it's foodie heaven. I went to food school there a while in Padstow.
Yeah.
And there's just so much to do, and it's so beautiful. And a lot of people in America are fanatic about the TV series Poldark,
both the
old and the new.
Yeah.
And so they, of course, flock there like crazy.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of Poldark scenes down there.
Yeah.
And you've got a World Heritage site right at the sort of very tip near a place called Senen, which has got a lot of the old tin mines there that are in those famous scenes. You have a place called St. Ives, which is where lots of artists flock to, and they're doing, there's lots of galleries there. And as you said, there's places which are dedicated towards surfing and surf schools. That's one of the most enjoyable days that we had when I was doing the book. Spent a couple of days in a surf school. It was like all of a sudden, within 48 hours, we were all beach boys,
Yeah. I've been a surfer widow, actually.
Right.
In my time.
Yeah, yeah. It's very addictive. It really is. But even if you're not doing the full surfing, a lot of people go bodyboarding in Cornwall.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's just
And it's, really it's almost semi-tropical.
No, it's not.
Yeah. It's not. It's not. Just,
my okay. next sentence was going to be, the water is freezing. And it will take 25 minutes or something to acclimatise in there, even if you've got a wetsuit on. So don't go to these places. Tropical places, but absolutely, it's an essential thing to do.
Right. Okay, and so then the final region is almost another country, and that's Wales.
Yeah, it is another country, completely different country, which is, as soon as you go into Wales, you'll have all the road signs in English and also in Welsh. So it's very, very much got its own identity. And again, some marvellous coastline there, a national park called Pembrokeshire on the coast. St. David's is the smallest city in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
And beautiful cathedral there, which, according to legend, was if you make two pilgrimages to St. David's, it was the equivalent of one in Rome. So a lot of people went there, and it is actually the most gorgeous cathedral.
And you make the point that the cathedral is sort of set down into
it's very much a
valley. And so you can actually see it from above, which is kind of unusual for a cathedral.
Yeah, you could only really get to see St. David's Cathedral at the last second as you sort of walk down this road. It's very much hidden in this dip. So you do get this glorious view down onto the top of it, which obviously you don't get with hardly any other cathedral.
Yeah. Stunning. Mm. So the Wales takes us back to where we started, which was Liverpool.
Yeah, that's a full
so we've gone
trip.
All the way around. Yeah. So I think listeners can sense that there is so much to discover each of these regions, and each is different. And the 80 places that you highlight are each, I think, worth a visit for sure.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, each one of the 80 places is the book is designed to be a catalyst for fun, to go out to explore these places and, you know, take the family and have loads of fun while you're there.
And did your family go with you for a lot of the research?
They will. Yes, and the kids loved it, especially, as you can imagine. And for a time, they were referring to it as around the coast in 80 fish and chips.
Well, I was going to ask you because I love fish and chips. And where is the best fish and chips?
Right. Controversial topic. And it has to be said that there are hard fought competitions every year to find out which is the best fish and chip shop. So, a place called Stonehaven in Scotland on the east coast has got an absolute cracking fish and chip shop. It's called The Bay, and it's on the beach promenade up there in Stonehaven. Stonehaven's an amazing place. It's got this sort of centuries old tradition on New Year's Eve of having people swing these massive balls of fire around to see in the new year and to burn out the sort of demons of the past. So that's a great place to go for fish and chips. And also, it has to be said that there's another fish and chip shop in Stonehaven, not too far away. And that was the home of a controversial snack, the deep fried Mars bar.
Yes, so, deep fried Mars bar.
Have you?
They're very good.
Well, I think there's a sign up in the shop as well that says they'll deep fry anything for an extra 50p or something. So, you know, you can take whatever you want, banana or Snickers or whatever, and see what it's like. But yeah, we've got two fish and chip shops there. But if you go to any part of the sort of British coast, there'll be people who really disagree with me and will point towards their own favourite. But the great thing about them, one thing that everybody does agree on, I think, is that there are obviously fish and chip shops all around. The UK, we've got one just up the road from us, but everybody will agree that they taste a lot better when you're sat on the seafront eating them out of paper, looking at the sea.
Mm-hmm. And you also give readers a great sense of where is the best crab and lobster and all the other kind of seafood as well. And I wonder if you could just let me know what you thought the best meal was that you had around the coast.
Right, the best meal. Some people wouldn't call it a meal, but the best meal for me on the coastline is a Cornish pasty.
Oh yes.
Now a Cornish pasty, for people who don't know, is sort of a, I mean, it was designed by the by tin miners who wanted a sort of sturdy way to take the dinner to work with them. So this sort of pastry sandwich almost was sort of designed with a meat and potato and vegetable filling. And that sort of tradition continues. So there's a lot of places in Cornwall where you can get a Cornish pasty. Obviously the fillings are extremely diverse these days, so you can get almost anything inside a Cornish pasty. You can even get sweet and savoury ones. So you can, I've had meat and potato Cornish pasty. I've also had apple and cinnamon Cornish pasty. Mm. So, you know, you might fancy the sweet or the savoury, but for me, it's got to be the Cornish pasty. And I always end up putting a bit of weight on when I go to Cornwall, because it's a pasty a day is the essential.
And the good news is that there's so many good places to walk, because you have to walk about 10 miles, I think, to walk off a Cornish pasty. They're very, very rich.
Yeah, so yeah. There's a lot of coastal paths where you can walk it off. Or maybe have a game of football on the beach or something afterwards.
Yeah, and I speaking of the walks, you have so many great recommendations for walks, but are most of the coastal paths protected by the National Trust, or how are they all maintained?
The National Trust owns a lot of land, particularly mm-hmm. in Cornwall, but certainly not all the coastline. So the paths will be maintained by a number of different organisations. So some are National Trusts. In some cases, it's just down to the individual farmers that own the land. So, there's there's a lot of different landowners, I think, in charge of looking after the paths. One thing that is on the horizon, though, quite excitedly, is going to be a path around the entire coast, linking everything up. So that would take a long time to do. But while I was on this sort of expedition, if you like, going around and doing it in my car, I did meet somebody who was walking it and sort of spoke to them. They'd just set out, so they were on about day 8 or something like that, and he sort of told me about his Facebook page that he'd got. And yeah, I sort of followed him on that to check out how he was going on. And he was still doing it half a year later. So,
oh my goodness.
It's a big undertaking. A big undertaking.
It is. Okay. And where's the best beach in Britain?
Best beach, I would go for a place in Cornwall called Senen, where the surfing is fantastic. And it's also got the things you need as a family. Like, it's got a nice shop, and it's got like a cafe and toilets and stuff like that. But literally, you are spoiled for choice when you're in Cornwall.
That's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also wanted to, Britain, famously, it rains a lot. But where do you think is the best weather?
Yeah, that is another controversy. Probably the best thing to do is if you manage to hit a beautiful week in Scotland, that would probably be best, to head up to some of the isolated beaches up there if you get the weather right. The chances are you're not going to get the weather right. And you can bet that if you've booked a holiday up there like 3 or 4 months in advance, you're going to hit a lot of wind and a lot of rain. So the best bet for weather is to go down to the southwest, to Cornwall. And hopefully, fingers crossed, you'll be in for some sunshine. But the golden rule is, with the British weather, if you wake up and it's sunny, you head to the beach. That's it. Because if you go down there for a week or maybe 2 weeks, you're going to get, at least 3, 4, 5 days of wind and rain. So you save the indoor, save the indoor things for those days. And if it's sunny, you get out there and you take the sun while it's on offer.
That's fantastic. So, Peter, this was obviously something of a labor of love for you.
Yeah.
I mean, you say that you've loved the coastal region since you were a child, and clearly you're passing that on to your children. I wonder what surprised you the most while you made your expedition.
Seeing some of the changes, I think, to places where I'd been before, maybe 15, 20 years ago, and seeing how they changed and been transformed. But also, the flip side of that is just seeing how some places had just stayed the same. So you were able to, pass on things that you'd seen and done as a child before. But it was also good. I used to live in Morecambe, actually, for a short period of time while I was at university. And it was in the 90s. It was not a great place to live there. Mm. And it's been really nice going back there and seeing the improvement and seeing how much of a better place it is. And the same goes for Liverpool as well. I visited Liverpool in the 90s, and a lot of cities were, on a downward slope during the 90s. And going back there 20, 30 years later and seeing how much it has completely been transformed into, one of the best cities in Europe, I think it's been really surprising. Yeah.
No, I I think it's included on travel itineraries and people are just loving Liverpool for sure.
Yeah, it has got a reputation now as a place, and then not many sort of northern cities in England are like that, as a place where you would go for maybe a long weekend and stay there. And I was just talking to some friends the other day, actually. I'm from Sheffield in the middle, and Sheffield's not a place where you would come and spend a long weekend in the city centre. There's lots of countryside around it that's nice, but Liverpool's got that sort of tourist attraction and that appeal.
Well, with the way everything changes, you'll need to do an update pretty soon.
Yeah.
The book.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great thing about writing a guidebook. As soon as you're finished, boom, you have to start working on the next one. So what is the next project for you? I know you have a book about underground Britain.
Yeah. The underground Britain was released last year. And that is a guide to 50 of the best things to do beneath the surface of of the country, which is, again, talk about surprises. I didn't think there'd be all the diversity and things there are to do beneath the surface, but there are more people working in tourism now beneath the surface of Britain than there are in mining.
So
a lot of these sort of old historical sites have been transformed into tourist attractions. But the next thing for me is a journey to 200 islands around the coast of Britain and Ireland. So that's going to be out next year, I think.
So those will be more sort of easy journeys where you just get in your car and you go, and or you'll be waiting for the ferryman, I think.
And on a ferry. Well, I've already done I've already had a few rough crossings already.
Yeah.
So I went to the Isle of Man, and that was a very rough crossing coming back from there. I didn't factor all these things in when I agreed to do it.
Well, I hope you'll come back and tell us about all these 200 islands when you finish. Finally, then, where can our listeners find out more about you and your work, and where can they get a hold of a copy of Around the Coast in 80 Days?
Around the Coast in 80 Days is available on Amazon and the Bloomsbury website. And I have a website, which is www.peter-naldred.co.uk. And I'm also on Twitter ranting about various things with the handle @PeterNaldred.
Great. Well, we'll link all of those important pieces of information in the show notes. Peter, this has been a delightfully bracing chat as I sit in Western Massachusetts. I'm still hungry for some fish and chips. So thank you so much.
We'll put plenty of salt and vinegar on them.
Yes. Thank you so much for joining me today. And thank you for joining us today on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jennifer Yeremeyeva, and I will be back soon with another interview about a new book with its author. Until next time.